following episode of Cooking Issues has been sponsored by Acme Smoked Fish. Located in Greenpoint, Brooklyn, Acme has been a mainstay in New York's culinary landscape for over 55 years. Using old-world recipes, Acme produces the finest smoked salmon, whitefish, and sable that discerning palates demand. For more information on where to find Acme, Blue Hill Bay, or Ruby Bay products, please visit www.acmesmokedfish.com.
Dave, you're on.
Cooking Issues. Cooking Issues Radio. Dave Arnold coming to you live from Berlin, Germany, where I'm at the Berlin Cocktail Conference. I have Nastasha sitting in the studio in Brooklyn. Is there, Nastasha?
Hi, Dave.
Hey. Yeah, so this radio show is being literally phoned in. I'm phoning it in from Berlin on my iPhone, so if I click or pop, you'll know why. And Nastasha, thanks so much for putting Phil Collins on as our intro music today.
They couldn't find your song.
Yeah, so, you know, everyone likes Phil Collins every now and again, so that's perfect.
Everyone has two ears and a heart, Dave.
Exactly. All right. So listen, so Nastasha, can you read the number since I don't have it in front of me and for some reason I cannot commit it to memory?
Yes. If you want to call in and ask questions to Dave, who's in Germany, the number is 718-497-2128. 718-497-2128.
I would really like it if someone from Germany called New York to ask me a question while I'm in Germany. We'll see if we can get that going. And we'll be here live for the next 45 minutes or so. And meanwhile, I'm going to take some email questions. So one of our favorite blog readers, Schinder Hannes, wrote actually from Germany, but not from Berlin. And he says, he said, why are the two most important beverages in Germany, beer and apple juice, beer for adults and apple juice for kids, used so rarely in cocktails? And do you have any good recipes for these ingredients? Schinder Hannes is an excellent question. The problem with apple juice in cocktails is that apple juice is relatively diluted. So most cocktails that are produced in bars, and therefore also most recipes that are written for them, are based on the idea that you're going to make a drink and then dilute it with, chill it and dilute it with ice. Now, the problem is that if you're using apple juice, by the time it's chilled and diluted, it's just much too watery. So you're not going to have enough alcohol in it, and you're also not going to have enough flavor of the apple juice. And so I think that's the reason why there aren't that many drinks using it. Now, of course, the solution to this is to chill your drinks beforehand, right, or mix them cold and then chill them down so that when they're mixed together, you don't have to dilute it a lot with ice. A really good technique is to actually freeze the apple juice into ice cubes and then shake with the frozen apple juice. And this way, as it's chilling and diluting, you can get it really cold, the same as a standard cocktail, about -7 Celsius. But as it's diluting with apple juice. And this technique works really well and something we do a lot. I like apple juice and whiskey. I think it's really good. When we use apple juice, though, we're often making our own apple juice, and we'll juice it with some ascorbic acid as an antioxidant, so that the apple juice stays green or yellow if it's a yellow apple, or red if there's a lot of red skin. And then, but it doesn't oxidize. It's the important part. And then often we'll clarify it and mix it. So we do a lot of work with that. We've done apple and tequila. We've done apple and bourbon. Most of the time we're only doing the apple juice and the spirit because we tend to use very high-quality apples, and we really want to show the flavors that of the specific apple. Most apple juice, once it's allowed to oxidize and clarify, traditionally the taste differences are muted somewhat. So that's one of the reasons we like to do it fresh. And some of our favorite apples are Ashmead's Kernel, which is an Old English variety, Sapa Spitzenberg, which is an Old American variety. Any local variety that you like, assuming it has a high enough acid balance, a good acid sugar balance, you can use. And of course, you can correct acid sugar with malic acid, which is the acid from apples, or you can obviously you can add more sugar to it. With regard to beers, there is like a, there are a whole bunch of cocktails based on beers. They're just not seen as often these days, like, you know, shandies. We do a lot of really old-school hot beer cocktails where we'll use like a beer, usually an ale, usually not a lager, usually an ale, and like either a brandy or sometimes a whiskey, and then we'll flame it using our red hot poker, which can basically, it can ignite the drink. You don't really need to ignite it, but you need to get something hot, like a hot stone or just very hot implement with it, like with a lot of thermal wallop to it, to give the kind of burned flavors that are really characteristic of those old-style drinks. And I really like to do that. I don't have any good modern beer recipes off the top of my head for cold cocktails, but they've become extremely popular in certain bars over the past 3 or 4 years in the States, and I think you're going to see a return to more beer-based cocktails in the future, especially in restaurants that have, they don't have a liquor license, right? So they can't serve liquor, but they can serve wine or beer. And so these places do a lot of interesting work with wine-based cocktails and beer-based cocktails. But unfortunately, I don't have any good recipes right off the bat. What do you think, Stas? Do you think that's a good answer or no?
Yeah, I think that's a good answer. Have you been drinking a lot of beer out there?
I've had some beer. So there's a characteristic beer from Berlin called Berliner Weiss that is, they sweeten it, the one I had with Woodruff syrup, so it's green. It's just like big goblet of green beer, and it's a little sweet, so I couldn't drink a lot of them, but whenever I go somewhere, I like to try the characteristic beverage of the area. But the person I ordered from it told me that it was mainly a ladies' drink, but I did enjoy it. I did enjoy it, so it was, and I have been drinking quite a bit of beer.
We have a caller.
Oh, we have a caller?
Yes.
Hello, caller. You're on the air.
Hi there. I'm Colin Gort. I'm living down in Washington, D.C., and recently I've been trying to make... I've been making sweetgrass vodka for quite a while. I've got a sweetgrass patch. I've just been usually just soaking it for a couple days, but when I saw the method you used with the EC canister, I tried doing some with... pressurizing with some nitrous oxide and trying to sort of blast some of the fresh, grassy flavor out. But something kind of curious happened. When I did it, I used, same concentrations I usually do and let it pressurize it with two charges, let it sit for a couple minutes, about between 2 and 3 minutes, let the gas out. And it didn't look too heavily colored. It was like very, very lightly. So I let it sit overnight in the fridge, like you do. And, it kind of looked the emerald thing that it usually has. But it's now been like maybe a week later. And whereas the regular stuff will be, still this kind of emerald color, this stuff has turned very tawny, very almost like a watered down coffee or tea color. And
what was the flavor again? I couldn't hear the very first part.
What was that?
What was it? Sadie, what was the flavor again? I couldn't hear.
Sweetgrass.
Oh, sweetgrass. Okay.
Interesting. All that.
I mean, I would bet, right? Like my guess, just off the beginning, and I don't know whether that the main question is the main question about the color.
Yeah, about the color. Also, the flavor profile is a little different. There's like, usually it's kind of very vanilla-y and grassy. There's still the kind of like grassy vanilla thing, but there's also a more, almost like brandy cherry thing that's not usually there. So I was wondering if, it's kind of the chlorophyll is getting blasted apart and that's what caused it to change color, or if you got any, ideas about what might be going on.
Yeah, I mean, I would almost guarantee that you're breaking some cells when you're doing it, and thereby releasing some enzymes, and the enzymes are getting to work busy oxidizing and creating some of those brown flavors. I mean, that would be my guess. Now, I think that, it's definitely true. So, like, if, for instance, when I'm doing an herb that I know has a tendency to go brown, when I do it, I'm trying to be as careful as I can and use herbs that aren't bruised, and also to not shake it real hard. I just swirl it around when I use those because I want to minimize breakage. But... also, we've had some luck, but not great luck, doping it with a little bit of an antioxidant. The problem is it's also then going to add acid, so it's going to change the flavor, like ascorbic acid. You could use sodium metabisulfite instead as an antioxidant, but I haven't tried it, so I can't talk about its efficacy. Now, the difference in flavor between the two, I think you have two different things going on. And I can't really judge like which one is working. And by the way, for people who don't know what we're talking about, go on to cookingissues.com and look up, infusion and ISI or EC, and you can see it's this technique where we do very rapid infusions of flavor in whipped cream makers. And, for me, it's really a good technique because it allows us to do something that we would normally use a vacuum machine to do, which is very expensive, and you could do it, fairly easily. And you could do it at home, you could do it in a bar. It's friendly, but the flavor profiles are different than they are with a traditional infusion that takes a long time. And so I think not necessarily better or worse, just different. So I think it's true that you're going to extract different flavors using this technique than you would using a traditional longer technique,
yeah,
right? I think the longer the product stays in there, the less the difference is going to be. But I also think you're probably getting some flavor change based on the oxidation. Don't you think so? I think that the actual oxidation is going to change the flavors. What do you think?
Yeah, I think so. But this is almost, in a pleasant way. So I was a little bit, I was just curious if, I guess it could be something enzymatic too, kind of breaking things down a little different.
Right. Well, as soon as something oxidizes, right? I mean, that's the thing. I think people don't. So when you add something like an antioxidant, like ascorbic acid, for instance, too. And we're talking a little bit about this in the last question. When you add something like this, yes, you're preventing oxidation, which is a visual cue that something's going on, but it also radically changes the taste. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's why apple juice, for instance, brown apple juice doesn't taste like fresh apples. It's because it's gone through this oxidation procedure. It's not just that it's been heated, although that also changes it, and it's not just that it's been clarified, but the actual oxidation where it goes brown is changing the characteristic flavor of a fresh apple into the characteristic flavor of the apple juice. So I think you might have some of that going on. And I think you also might have just perhaps a different extraction of things from it in general, you know?
Yeah. So are there some other instances where you notice that oxidation has maybe actually, like, improved flavor? Or is it generally a negative trend that you've...
I think it depends. People really like apple juice. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so oxidized apple juice, I mean, it's not what I'm shooting for, so I tend to go try to make it taste as fresh as possible. But again, oxidation there is not bad. It's just different. We normally associate it as being negative because we're used to it being a negative characteristic. And for instance, in things like pesto, and I think most herb oxidation, like basil uh-huh. oxidation and cilantro oxidation, has a very characteristic flavors, and we kind of shun those flavors, and so it takes on a bad name. But there's nothing inherently bad about oxidation. I think I might have told this story once on the cooking issues before, but I'll say it again real quick. There is I'm pretty sure I said it, but Reese's Peanut Butter Cups, which I won't use their name, but it's Reese's Peanut Butter Cups, they're characteristically oxidized, the fats oxidized a little bit in the peanut butter, and that's the characteristic taste of the Reese's Peanut Butter Cup. And if you actually put oxygen scavengers in the packaging so that it doesn't oxidize a little bit, nobody thinks it tastes like a Reese's Peanut Butter Cup anymore, and they don't want to buy it. So it's... So oxidation, it's all in the eye of the eater, or in the mouth of the eater, I guess.
Yeah.
Anyway, I hope that answered your question. Thanks for calling in. And you just post something to the blog if you have more results with the sweetgrass, because I'm interested. We haven't used any sweetgrass infusion. So
I'll call in. Once I have some more systematic stuff, I'll put it together and show you guys. But thanks for your help.
Very good. Thanks. Thank you.
We should take a break.
All right, so we're going to our first break, and we're going to come back live from our two-continent cooking issues from New York and from Berlin. Yeah.
Dave, you're on.
Hey, welcome back to Cooking Issues, coming to you live on the Heritage Radio Network every Tuesday, even when I'm in Germany. So we're coming to you live, like I said, Stasi's on the studio in Brooklyn at Roberta's Pizza, and I'm in the Berlin Cocktail Conference in Berlin. So Duncan from Sacramento writes in. Oh, by the way, call in your questions. We're still here for about another half hour or so. Nastasha, give them the number.
It is 718-497-2128, 718-497-2128.
All right, Duncan writes in from Sacramento and says he's been trying to make a stable foam from beer, so he's had a couple beer questions. If I like this, all these questions are working together today. I think it could be interesting to do a beer mousse or deconstruct a black and tan. However, I've not been able to get a dense and stable foam. Pectin hasn't worked, and I'm not sure gelatin would set up well in the presence of alcohol. Now, Duncan, if you're looking to do a traditional mousse style texture with gelatin, I guarantee you gelatin will set the beer fine. First of all, beer is not that high in alcohol, and so it will affect it a little bit. You might have to use a little more gelatin than you would normally use, but it's definitely going to work. I've done gelées of champagne many times with gelatin, and it works fine. If you want to make not a mousse, but just something that's dense and foamy, get a really good result, I will steer you to the same technique that Sam Mason, formerly of Atlas WD-50 and Taylor Restaurant, and currently has a bar. His name, for some reason, because I'm in Germany, has escaped me. He uses a product called Methocell F50, which is a methylcellulose product that is basically can whip anything into a mousse. It's not a mousse, really, a foam, but like dense. You know, not quite as dense as shaving cream, but much denser than your normal foams that you make, like an egg white. It's like an egg white meringue. And in fact, we use it to dehydrate foams into meringues, and I think we have a recipe somewhere on the blog, don't we, Stasi, for that?
Yeah,
for F50 and the hydrocarbon problem?
Yes. Yeah.
And so he famously made a Guinness foam using Methocell F50, and it makes a nice, dense, stable, like a little bit thicker than the head on a Guinness, but like of that kind of nature. And so that's a really good technique. Another one that you can use, if you don't like Methocell, you can buy Methocell, I think, at retail, I think at Le Sanctuaire's website, and also Terra Spice's website. And some people have a little bit of a gripe with Methocell because it's one of the only things we use. It's not, you know, quotes, all natural. It's not a chemical that is natural. It's modified cellulose product. So then people who have a problem with that sometimes will use something called VersaWhip, which is basically they have a soy-based VersaWhip, which is soy protein, as a whipping agent, and they have a casein, milk-based protein VersaWhip that you can also get, at both of those suppliers. And those can whip things into a denser foam. I find VersaWhip to be more difficult to use. I think Methocell F50, and remember, F50, don't get a different Methocell. F like Frank 50. That one, I think, is really easy to use. It whips up like an egg white. You might have to add a little bit of a thickener, like, I don't know, xanthan gum or maltodextrin or something to the beer to get it to foam up nicely, but it should work.
Dave, we have a caller.
Oh, we have a caller?
Yes.
All right, caller, you're on the air.
Hello, my name is Derek. I wrote in a couple weeks ago about a question about velvety meat.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, thanks a lot for the answer on that. That was great. I had another question I wanted to ask about today, which is, you mentioned a week or two ago something I've heard before about cooking sous vide, that as long as you sear it, you're basically safe because the inside of the meat is basically sterile. But I had to give this a second thought last week when I got a piece of monkfish and found some worms crawling out of it. I wanted to ask about dealing with parasites, and if you had some... because those obviously, you know, aren't only on the surface, but I know they're easier to kill than a lot of bacteria. But I wonder if you could address safety issues with those and how you might go about doing it.
All right, that's an interesting question. You pick monkfish, which obviously is full of parasites, also codfish full of parasites. Worms. I mean, luckily, I don't know about monkfish, but the ones in codfish aren't going to infect you, but they're incredibly disgusting. You know what I mean? You know, and in general, but the same thing holds true for traditional cooking in sous vide there. So our discussion is basically when you're cooking something sous vide, often we don't cook things enough to pasteurize them, enough to kill all the bacteria that's present, right? And the reason we don't is often if you cook something that long, the texture can be ruined, right? So that's true on certain beef muscle cuts like tenderloin, like filet. I think if you cook it long enough to pasteurize it, or temperatures where you're going to pasteurize it, that you can damage the the texture, but it's definitely true on fish. You really, it's very hard to cook most fish so that they're pasteurized because you don't ever really want to get them, in general, up to the temperatures. They could pasteurize them, and even when you do, you don't want to hold them there that long. Exceptions like striped bass can take those kind of temperatures, but so you don't tend to pasteurize them. Now, on something that like, contains a parasite, like a codfish or a monk, the fact of the matter is that when you're doing a traditional cook, you're also probably not getting the internals up high enough to be any different than you would in sous vide because, but you are overheating, you are really searing the outside and killing it. So I think my point with safety in sous vide is that I don't think it's any less safe than the traditional method. Does that make sense at all or no?
No, that makes perfect sense. Do you know what it does take?
I know that
a lot of these worms and things can be killed just by freezing or at much lower temperatures than a lot of bacteria and such. So I assume that generally makes it safe. So unless I'm making sushi out of it, it's probably okay. Does that sound about right?
Yeah, if you buy a sushi grade, first of all, like there's parasites in fish that will infect you, and those are the ones that they get rid of by freezing it. So anytime you're going to buy a sushi grade fish, it's been frozen to kill off those parasites, right? So once you're dealing with a sushi grade product, you're good to go. With regards to like the worms on a big piece of codfish, let's say, I have to go research because I have research. My recollection is that those are merely gross and not harmful. But I'm not going to swear on. I'm not going to tell people that, you know, on the radio because I haven't looked into it. But I also think that they're, like you said, I think they're probably fairly easy to kill. And that if you're, you know, that's why like I'd be a little worried about doing super low temperature work on a fish that's going to have a lot of parasites, because then you might get one of those suckers wriggling out of the plate, and that would customers running out, like free meals, you know, it would be a nightmare, you know, a huge nightmare. And we've all seen like worms coming out of cod or out of monkfish. I mean, they're just there. You know what I mean? And so, like for instance, the famous low temperature cod recipe, extreme low temperature cod recipe, is by Juan Roca from the sous vide book that came out a number of years ago in Spanish, which is one of the first books on sous vide, a really good book. Stas, you still there? I heard a click.
Yeah, I think the other guy dropped off.
All right. Sorry, I have to do this. I'm in Germany, but that recipe is famous. But it was mistranslated as cod. So people basically said that they were heating cod at extremely low temperature, like 100 Fahrenheit. And in fact, it was salt cod, where all of the that was reconstituted salt cod bacalao. And so all the worms are obviously killed. But anyway, what do you think, Stasi? Is that a good answer?
I think that's a good answer, Dave. Too bad we lost the guy.
All right.
Hopefully that helps.
I know. Yeah, hopefully that helps. So Duncan had a second question, which is he's been trying to learn with cast iron, but he's been having trouble with food sticking intermittently. And he says, as far as he can tell, the pan is seasoned, but sometimes omelets will stick to it and sometimes they won't. Well, I think I can't see your pan, obviously, because I'm in Berlin, and you're in Sacramento. But things can look seasoned, but they're not really seasoned as well as if they had been seasoned for years and years of use. So the initial seasoning isn't really enough to make something kind of bulletproof nonstick. First of all, nothing's bulletproof nonstick. But I think what's probably happening is you probably have a couple of high spots in the pan that can cause adhesion, and then once it adheres, it adheres pretty well to that point. And so maybe you didn't get a coating of oil over one particular section, or it dried out, or somehow you got adhesion to the pan, and the more you use it, the less and less it's going to stick. Especially these newer cast iron, they're rougher in surface. I tend to find that, until you build up a really good season on them, they're not really, even though some people theoretically think that the roughness is going to help you in nonstick phenomenons, I don't happen to be one of those people who believes it. I mean, I think there's been a lot of discussion on that on the blog. If you look at the blog on I think it's called, what's it called, Stasi? Like Heavy Metal, the Science of Cast Iron, or something like this?
Yes.
Yeah. I haven't researched it recently, but, my thoughts fresh from the research are in that post if anyone wants to go back and look at it. Chris Anderson writes in, and he says he enjoys the show, which we appreciate, right, Stasi?
Yes.
We appreciate that. And he says, what is the correct ratio in making a simple syrup? Every recipe I find seems to have a different proportion of sugar to water. Does the dilution depend on the application? And then he goes, he has a question about the shelf life of the syrup. Should it be stored in the fridge, et cetera, or will that make the sugar crystallize? And he's noticed that when he infuses things into it, like lavender or lemongrass, it tends to last not very long before it starts to mold on the top, and that straight sugar seems to last longer. Can he extend the shelf life, et cetera, et cetera? These are all interesting questions. First of all, let me start by saying that there is no correct, simple syrup recipe. Like, there's all different ratios that you can use, and but the particular recipe isn't going to taste the same as what the writer intended unless you use the same proportions that they asked for. So I tend, and we at the school tend to use what's called a 2-to-1 simple syrup, and everyone makes it differently. In a bar place, they tend to make their syrup based on volume because they don't have scales. They have cup measures. So they'll make simple syrup based on volume. Now, luckily, standard American granulated sugar weighs about this close to the same as water on a volume basis, just lucky. So a weight simple syrup and a volume simple syrup are about the same when made with U.S. granulated sugar. Now, in a bar, they tend to make 1-to-1 simple syrup because they're not heating it even. They're using superfine syrup, which is going to make it sweeter because it's denser. So erase what I just said. But they're using superfine sugar, which dissolves very quickly, and they're stirring it because they don't necessarily have a heat source right there, and they want to be able to make their simple syrup without heat. So they tend to make a 1-to-1 simple syrup. And they tend to do it by volume, and they tend to with superfine sugar. So, like, that should be like that's if a bar recipe just says simple syrup 1-to-1, that's probably what they mean. Another reason that bartenders tend to use a lighter simple syrup like that is because it pours a lot faster and you leave a lot less syrup in the bottom of your jigger. The downside of it is that simple syrup also adds a lot more water for an equivalent amount of sweetness, so it can throw off the dilution in certain recipes. I tend to prefer to add sugar in the form of sugar and make a denser simple syrup. So when usually, unless I say otherwise, my simple syrup is 2-to-1, 2 parts sugar to 1 part water by weight, and then heat it until it dissolves and then allowed to cool down. And when I need it in a hurry, I do four parts sugar to 1 part water, heat it till it dissolves, and then I throw ice cubes to chill it down quickly. And that's how I make it. Now, the more sugar you put in a simple syrup, the less chance you're going to get of mold developing. A 1-to-1 simple syrup is definitely going to mold over time. If you store it in the fridge, it's not going to mold over time. I don't think. I've never really had them go moldy in the fridge. Then you have to devote storage space to it in the fridge. A 2-to-1 simple syrup probably won't mold as much. It'll still mold if it's outside, and you keep it in the fridge as well. Now, you might get some crystallization in your 2-to-1, but you're not going to get that much crystallization in your 2-to-1. I wouldn't worry about it so much. Now, when you're infusing a syrup, the question whether or not, what kind of shelf life you're going to get out of it, a lot depends on, and by the way, if you have to leave your simple syrup out because, you don't have fridge space or whatever, if you're going to keep it for a long period of time, if you, once a week just, bring it up almost to the boil and let it drop down again, you're going to kill the mold in it and you get to extend the shelf life again because it's not going to get unsafe on you. Now, when you're doing an infusion, like an herb or whatnot, you're probably getting more water. And it also depends if you're going to boil the thing that you're infusing with the sugar, right, then, you might be killing some stuff into it, but you're probably introducing some spores and whatnot, some mold into it. And you're probably also giving it more of a substrate to act on. So that might be one of the reasons that you're getting more spoilage. I haven't researched any specific, mold inhibitors, although that's an interesting question. Maybe we should look into it, Stasi.
Yes.
But I think you're going to definitely increase the life of those things by putting them in the fridge, and I don't think that any crystallization, definitely not on a 1-to-1 and even on a 2-to-1. I've had 2-to-1 in my fridge for months, and, you'll get a couple of crystals around the bottom of it, but not a huge, huge deal. So in terms of consistency, I don't think there's a best or a worst. There's what fits your cooking style best. We have both 1-to-1 and 2-to-1 around. It's all about being consistent from time to time.
Right. We need to take a break, Dave. They're telling me.
Oh. All right. So we're taking a break. Coming back with the last segment of Cooking Issues. You still have time to call in.
No, I can have fun.
Okay, Dave, you're on.
Dave? All right, welcome back to Cooking Issues. Doing it to you in two time then. So we're in Berlin and we're in New York. So some time to call in. Stasi, what's the number again?
718-497-2128. 718-497-2128.
So Jay wrote us and asked us a question about protein in flours, and he or she, this is Jay, referenced Harold McGee. And so rather than answer this question, I'm just telling you, Jay, I'm going to wait because Harold McGee is actually going to come and teach a class in less than 2 weeks. What are the dates again, Sasha?
October 21st and 22nd. That's a Thursday and Friday.
Right. So Harold McGee is actually coming to the French Culinary all day, 2 day class. He's coming to teach the Harold McGee class. We'll probably put something up on the blog in advance of it. But anyway, I'm going to be spending some quality time with him, and you can too if you want. There are still spots. Go to the FCI website, FrenchCulinary.com, and look for the Harold McGee lecture series. But I'm going to spend some quality time with him, and he is really up on these kinds of things and has done a lot of research. So, Nastasha, I'm going to put the protein question, flour protein question, down as a whole because I want to give Jay a better answer when we're hanging with McGee.
Okay.
All right. So, now, we have a question. Let me see if I can find it. And the thing is, when I cook for my... This is Teddy DeVico writes in. It says, when I cook for my family, my dad cannot eat salt or any food that contains salt, so I have to cook without salt for him. I still cook for the rest of my family with salt. He does not believe that salt can make food drastically better, but I tell him it does. Why does salt make food taste better? And is there any way to make food taste good without salt? And by the way, Teddy does not think it is possible. So you're right. It's not possible. It turns out that salt. And I don't know whether your dad dislikes salt or whether or not he is one of the few people that is actually sensitive to salt from a blood pressure situation. But I mean, salt, sodium chloride, is 100% necessary to your survival as a human being. Okay, so your neurons don't work without sodium. Like, we don't work. There is no life for us without sodium, and we don't make it ourselves. So we have to take it in. In fact, mammals and other things, even humans, although there's some controversy about how it works because there's some controversy, but we have what's called salt appetite. So other than thirst, where you're like, I'm thirsty, I need liquid, the only other thing that works that way is salt, where there's like you have a salt appetite. At least mammals do. Whether or not humans have the same kind of salt thing that primates do is up for question. So salt is definitely something you need, but you don't necessarily need to sprinkle salt on things because food that you eat naturally contains more or less salt depending on what it is naturally in the product. Meats have a certain amount of salt in them because they come from animals, and animals contain sodium. But, natural mineral waters contain sometimes a good bit of salt in them, depending on which one you choose. Hell, there's plants that grow, like, for instance, samphire or sea beans grows on the seashore, and it has so much salt in it that I don't even need to add salt to my salads when I make it with that, and I like salt a lot. So you're always consuming salt. It's just a question of whether or not you add salt. So then the question is, do you need to add salt to food? And for me, yes, you do. So for instance, the classic food that sucks without salt is bread, right? And so, everyone in the world loves Tuscan cuisine, myself included. I love it. Except for the bread is horrible. Right, Stasi? Come on, the bread's horrible.
We've had this discussion. Yeah. I don't mind it. I like the sprinkle.
It's horrible.
All right.
But here, Stasi thinks that you can sprinkle salt on Tuscan bread and all of a sudden make it real bread.
Yes.
I completely disagree because I have baked breads where you accidentally forget to put the salt in. How many out there has this happened to you? You forget to put the salt in, and then you pray that you can make it better by adding salt. Here's why you can't. Because first of all, the salt's not throughout the dough. And second of all, the salt actually affects the texture because it affects the way the gluten works. And so you'll notice that the crust on a saltless bread, the reason Tuscan bread looks like crap on the outside, it's that sallow-looking crust, is because they don't have salt. And the reason the texture is not as good is because they don't have salt. And the reason it doesn't taste good is because, can you guess why, Nastasha?
It doesn't have salt.
Right, because it doesn't have salt. And you can't fix those problems just by sprinkling salt on the outside. That's like rolling a turd in sequins. You know what I mean? It just doesn't work. So another place where salt is, often useful, not just from a taste standpoint, is with meats, because salt actually increases the water binding capacity of meat. So the when you brine something, you're actually ensuring that it's going to be juicier by applying some salt to it beforehand. So it's actually performing a functional characteristic there. Now, the vast majority of the huge sodium intake, by the way, like our great-grandparents' generation ate a boatload more salt than we do, because they had to eat everything preserved, or had to eat more preserved things than we do. And in fact, they were more heavily salted. Preserved meats were more heavily salted in the old days than they are now, because now we have refrigeration. I just read a scholarly paper, I forget what it is, so I can't reference it, but they said that nothing more drastically reduced the salt intake of the population in general than the refrigerator, because now all of a sudden we didn't need to salt anymore. So this modern idea that we consume so much more salt now because of processed foods, in quotes, than we used to, is absurd, because salt used to be like everywhere. Everything was salted down to preserve it, prior to the advent of refrigeration. So we love salt because we need it. It also makes things taste delicious, So salt affects, first of all, you don't need to salt a lot. In other words, you don't need to make something salty to have the salt have a beneficial effect. Like, for instance, a little bit of salt in a drink, even if you can't taste the salt, it's going to round out the flavors. It changes your perception of aroma. So when you add salt to a broth, it's actually changing the aroma of the broth, because it alters the way the volatiles are, basically, like the amount of them that are captured allows things to release, come off, and you actually get a stronger impact of volatiles in the aroma. It tends to be synergistic, so it makes other things taste better without even necessarily having the perception of salt. And they tried to get around that by adding things like MSG, which can also increase the palatability of something without adding a lot more salt. Although gram per gram, MSG adds about one-third the sodium that salt does, because we usually get monosodium glutamate. It doesn't add as much salt per gram as much sodium per gram as salt does. And it's the sodium people are worried about, by the way. Most of the flavor comes from the sodium. The chloride is kind of usually along for the ride, right? But the other thing about MSG, even though it does have sodium in it, you typically would use a lot less MSG than you would use salt, because it's more potent. This is a long way. I don't know whether I've I totally answered this question.
It all depends.
Question.
Yeah, what's wrong with his dad, right? Like, if for health reasons, or if he just doesn't like salt. But yeah,
There's got to be some people that don't like salt. There's only like one or two groups of people in the world that are known to not add any salt. I always forget what they are. It's probably like some Inuit culture or something like that. But again, they're eating whale meat out of the ocean. I don't even remember whether it's Inuit. I just made that up. But there's very few cultures in the world that don't use salt, and it's because this stuff tastes good. You know what I mean? Maybe I'll do some more research on it and talk about it at a later point. And he says, on another note, what do I think of Grant Aikens' aviary bar? Grant Aikens, as most of the readers will know, is the chef at Alinea, which is a very, very fine restaurant. I've eaten there twice. Had an extraordinary meal when I was there. I have not been to the bar. Is it open yet?
I have no idea, no.
I do not know if it's open. I hear they've had some YouTube videos up, so maybe they are. But I'm sure whatever Grant does is going to be good, but I just haven't tried it yet. Now, I have one more question from, who's this one? Steve. And by the way, Steve says, P.S., thanks for talking about the issues of tall cooks. We're trying to get Mark Ladner, right?
He won't talk on here.
Well, maybe I'll just get his... Why don't you get his comments separately, and we'll just say what he said.
Okay.
How about that?
That's good.
Yeah. So we can do that. But he's basically... He's a physicist, and he's interested in ice. And he was just talking about something really cool, which is he makes spherical lenses out of ice so that he can start fires outside. That's pretty cool, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So basically, you know, he says that, you know, you can basically with your hands just take a block of ice and smooth it out, you know, heating it to make a decent enough sphere to light a fire using it, which is, I think that's pretty cool. I'd like to try that. But so he's wondering about the problems of making clear ice, because you need clear ice to make these lenses. And he, you know, he's talking about the difficulties in it. And have we talked about clear ice on the radio at all, Stasi, or no?
I feel like we did, or maybe you touched on it a little bit, but not in depth.
Yeah, so basically, back in the day, prior to, you know, mechanical refrigeration, most ice that was used in restaurants, bars, or in ice houses was harvested ice that was harvested from lakes and rivers in the wintertime. It was sawn out in big blocks and then kept in huge insulated ice houses for use throughout the year. Now, the benefit of this kind of ice is that it's formed in thin layers, as you know, Steve mentioned. I mean, he knows much better than I do because he's a physicist, but it forms in thin layers, and what happens when it's forming in thin layers is that the impurities in it, gas and any other actual dissolved impurities, don't get integrated into the crystal matrix of the ice. So when you're freezing in your freezer, here's what happens. You have an ice cube tray. It starts to freeze on the bottom. The impurities are getting concentrated in the center, as are the dissolved gases. And then at a certain point, the top of your ice cube freezes over, and then the inside, first of all, expands as it freezes, because ice expands as it freezes, and all the impurities are there, and the gas is there, and you have a big, like, messy, you know, cloudy, you know, ball in the middle of your ice cube. You know what I'm talking about, right, Stas?
Right, yes.
Yeah, right. So that's what's happening. So in lakes, that doesn't happen because you're depositing thin layers that are constantly being washed, and the layers are built up and they're totally clear. And as Steve points out, that's the same way icicles are formed, which is why icicles are also clear. So I guess you can maybe make a good lens out of that. The problem with doing it at home is that it's just not easy. Even just degassing your ice cube trays in a vacuum machine isn't going to necessarily, it's not going to give you clear ice, because the top will freeze over as the inside expands and breaks the crystal structure and reforms. You'll get parts that are cloudy. Also, it's just difficult. Or using distilled water won't solve the problem. The only way to really solve it is the way that the Kleinbel is the ice manufacturers that make the machines for ice carvers, right? So ice carvers require clear ice. And so bartenders have started using this, what they call it, Kleinbel ice, which is very clear, and it basically works like a lake upside down. They make sure that the freezing happens from the bottom of the cube up, and they keep the water circulating on the top so that the top can't freeze over. And as it's built up slowly over the course of a day or so, because it takes, between 24 and 48 hours to freeze one of these 200-pound blocks in a Kleinbel, like, as it's freezing slowly up, none of the impurities are incorporated, and they're concentrated in the water that's on top. And at the end, they just drain that the impure, crappy water off the top, and they're left with a block of perfectly pure crystal ice. And so that's how it's made. Now, it's difficult to do at home, you know, unless you have, like, an anti-griddle and, you know, a chest freezer, but it's not something you can just kind of do in your freezer. But the good news is that, you know, clear ice looks amazing, and it's the only one that you can really carve well, because it's very easy to carve and it doesn't shatter. It's not really going to make your drink taste better. So that's the good news. Anyway, Stasi, how are we doing on time?
We're doing fine. I think we have, like, 2 minutes left, so say something.
We have
great.
2 minutes left?
Yeah.
All right. So I will, you know, relay what it takes to get stopped in the Dusseldorf airport in between flights and have basically a full body cavity search.
So, no way, really?
So don't leave your job at a cooking school after you do a demo with your folding box cutter, which, by the way, like, everyone in the world should have a folding box cutter in their pocket at all times. Like, in fact, the thing I hate most about traveling is that I can't have my folding box cutter with me unless I know where I can get blades for it. So anyway, I go to JFK, which is our airport in New York. I take the box cutter out of my pocket, and I discard the blade and put the empty box cutter, sans blade, back in my pocket, because I don't feel like I'm a human being unless I have a box cutter in my pocket, right? So the and, you know, this probably says something bad about security in New York. I showed him the empty box cutter. I'm like, hey, it's a box cutter without a knife. What's the problem? They're like, hey, right, what's the problem? Let me through. I show up in Germany, in Düsseldorf, and I have to go through security again. I show him, I was like, you know, es gab kein Messer, you know, there's no knife in there, right? But then they literally took apart everything, including my shoes, everything I owned, took everything apart to look to see whether I had stashed a blade somewhere
with my
box cutter. And then they're looking through it, and they see a box that I brought, because I'm doing a cocktail demonstration here where we're testing temperature, and I'm doing basically a recap of the Tales of the Cocktail that I did with Eben Clem, and you can go see that on our blog about the cocktail science post. So he finds this box with all these wires coming out of it, and he's looking at me a little more than cross-eyed, and my German, by the way, is not so good. And then after that, he finds I'm, you know, studying organic chemistry again, boning up on it, and I have a chemical model set in my thing, and he sees chemistry, wires, and a dude with a box cutter, who I'm clearly disheveled, you know, from my flight, and so that's what it takes to basically, you know, get the full smackdown in the Düsseldorf airport. So this has been your Intercontinental Cooking Issues episode. Thanks to Heritage Radio for making it happen. Thanks to Acme Fish. Thank you, Nastasha, and we'll see you next week.